Morning, everyone. Welcome to the court. Is everyone ready to proceed? All right, Ms. Bukit-Kalin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. Gerard Lau, Deputy Attorney General for the State of Hawaii. Plaintiff beachfront landowners claim that Act 73 in 2003 affected a taking of a treated land requiring just compensation. We will demonstrate that no taking occurred with respect to each of the three classes of accreted land. Class 1 accreted land, which is that formed prior to the enactment of Act 221 in 1985. Class 2 accreted land, which is that formed after Act 221, but before Act 73 in 2003. And Class 3 accreted land, which is that formed after Act 73 in 2003. Now, it's important to remember that Act 221 in 1985 changed the common law of accreted land to no longer grant newly accreted land to the beachfront landowner, requiring the accretion to be, quote, permanent, in other words, remain for 20 years before the landowner could own it. But before such newly accreted land reached 20 years, however, and thus before landowners ever gained any ownership interest in those Class 2 accretions, the Hawaii legislature enacted Act 73, denying anyone...
Let me ask you a question. Assuming we agree with your interpretation of the effect of Act 221, who owned the land in the intervening period from the time before the 20-year period took effect? In other words, who was the actual owner of the land in that gap period?
I would suggest it was the state of Hawaii, because the state generally owns the land, anything other than from the beach, from the submerged lands all the way up there. So if it's not the land front, if it's not the literal landowner, it would have to be the state of Hawaii.
So but in that gap period, you're saying that the landowner had no right to use that property or otherwise treat it as if they owned that property.
Absolutely correct. And that is the effect of Act 221.
Prior to Act 221, could shoreline owners register title to land?
Yes. Prior to Act 221 in 1985, if there was accreted land, they could register, they could quiet title to it. But after Act 221, Act 221 basically said that with respect to newly accreted land, it would no longer be registrable, quiet titleable, and would not be owned by the literal landowner until it became permanent, and that is until it remained for 20 years.
And how did they prove that they owned this land that they're trying to register?
I mean, I guess that would be a question of proof. You'd have to have witnesses come in and testify one way or the other as to when the accreted land formed.
But there was no time limit, and that was the purpose of Act 221, to impose a time limit for proving how long the land was.
Well, the purpose of Act 221 was to ensure that further accreted land would not automatically go to the littoral landowner, and it was also to basically protect public access, ensure that public trust doctrine was preserved, and ensure basically public beach access and public enjoyment of the beaches. And so Act 221 said, unless that newly accreted land stayed for 20 years, the littoral landowner, the beachfront landowner, would no longer have access or ownership of that property.
So under the common law, there was no time period required, no requirement that you had to establish that the accretion was permanent for a set period of time.
That's correct.
So as soon as you could show that you get a surveyor out there and say, hey, we got a foot, you could theoretically go and register that.
I think theoretically, that as a practical matter, you might not do it, but I think theoretically that was probably the case. I have not found anything that suggested that, you know, the beachfront landowner didn't own it. But Act 221 changed everything, and that's the key and important fact in this case, because once Act 221 came into effect, no longer would newly accreted land automatically go to the beachfront landowner. In fact, the beachfront landowner would have no ownership interest whatsoever until 20 years passed, if in fact 20 years ever passed and the accretion remained in existence.
What do these deeds look like when you're a shoreline property owner? I get the sense that the three sides have meets and bounds descriptions, but the portion along the ocean just says the high watermark?
Yes, and looking at the deeds that are involved in this case, that is exactly what they do. They do mention the high watermark. Some of them put also azimuths and meets and bounds and things like that, but under Hawaii case law, the meets and bounds will defer to ultimately the high watermark.
So then how do you prove what the high watermark is from year to year?
Again, that would be a problem of having witnesses come in and testify as to where they saw the high water mark, and I agree there may be practical difficulties as a matter of proof.
So those six people who got their lands registered after Act 221 that are mentioned in the record, how did they prove their ownership?
I mean, they would have to have people testify to the effect that these accreted lands had formed prior to Act 221. And you know, it's a problem of proof, but that's a problem that would arise in any case.
I noticed that the land board has adopted some rules on shoreline certifications, which require basically yearly certifications. They're taking maps and surveys. I mean, that sounds like a very expensive proposition, but is that what happens? You have to prove that for each year of the 20 years that it has stayed the same, the boundaries?
Well, I don't know if it has to stay the same, but basically if you want to claim title to a particular section of accreted land, you're going to have to show that accreted land has been there for 20 years.
The complaint in this case doesn't mention that the Mauna Loa Bay owners have accreted lands, do they? Is there accreted lands in this case?
Their complaint seems to assert claims with respect to both. Whether they in fact actually have accreted land, you can ask the plaintiffs. I'm not totally sure whether they actually have particular accreted land in this case. Certainly if they didn't, then there would be arguably no right claim in this case. But let me address Class 1 accreted lands first. Act 73 indisputably does not affect Class 1 accreted lands, that is, lands accreted before Act 221 in 1985. And therefore, because it has no effect on Class 1 accreted lands, it could not possibly affect the taking. And the reason Act 73 has no effect on Class 1 accreted lands is for three compelling reasons. First, the general rule is that laws are not to be given retrospective effect unless expressly or obviously intended. Here, there's nothing in Act 73 that expressly requires it to apply to Class 1 accretions that had basically been in existence for more than 18 years. In fact, the legislative history indicates it was aimed only at new expansions of beachfront property, not old ones, and that's in the Standing Committee Report 1224, where it says this measure will help protect Hawaii's public lands and fragile beaches by ensuring that coastal property owners do not inappropriately claim newly deposited lands, makai of their property. Second, if Act 73 were to apply to Class 1 accretions, it would impair existing rights by taking away long-enjoyed ownership of Class 1 accretions.
And so long under your interpretation of Act 73, if I own land prior to 1985 that had accreted, I could still register it?
Yes.
But the plain language of the statute indicates that the only party that can register lands would be the state of Hawaii. So you're saying that you look at that prospectively only, and so we have to read the statute in that fashion despite its literal.
This is Act 221 in 1985, which doesn't do that. It's Act 73 that specifically changes it and says now that only the state can own accreted land.
But is your position that even after Act 73, if I owned land that had accreted as of 1985, prior to 221, I could still go to
yes,
the land court and register it by proving that as of 1985 it had already accreted.
Correct.
Isn't that inconsistent with the statutory language of 73?
I'm sorry?
Isn't that inconsistent with the statutory language of 73, which says that the state is the only party that can register accreted land?
Yeah, I think because the legislative history specifically says it was concerned about newly deposited land, I think to apply Act 73 to Class 1 accreted land that had been in existence for over 18 years would be inconsistent with the intent of the legislature. And again, so I think we have at least an ambiguity, and given the other two propositions that Wong versus Takeuchi says you don't interpret something to impair existing rights, which could happen if you prevented Class 1 accretions from being owned by the littoral landowner. That by itself dictates resolving the ambiguity against implying
so
it
you
to
say
Class
not,
1
notwithstanding the possible interpretation of 73 to say that only the state cannot register, we would have to interpret it to mean only register except for if you could prove prior to 85
correct
that you had the accretion, you could still register.
Correct. And another proposition for reason for doing that is the other doctrine of in Ray Doe, which says where a statute is susceptible to two constructions, one of which raises grave and doubtful constitutional questions, the duty is to interpret or use the construction that avoids the constitutional question. And finally, if nothing else, state does not assert any interest in applying Act 73 to Class 1 accretions, and therefore plaintiffs have no evidence that we would try to apply Act 73 to Class 1 accretions, and therefore plaintiffs' attempt to constitutionally challenge an interpretation that the state doesn't assert would violate the ripeness doctrine. Now, moving on to Class 2 accretions, and this is the real crux of this case, that Class 2 accretions, which were formed after Act 221 in 1985, but before Act 73 in 2003, Act 73 affects note taking for the following reasons. To evaluate the impact of Act 73 upon the beachfronters, I will call them beachfronters for short, one must consider the state of the law immediately prior to Act 73. Act 221, 18 years earlier, had already substantially limited and altered the beachfronters' interest in Class 2 accretions. Because Act 221 said that new accretions would no longer be owned by the beachfronter unless until they became permanent, i.e. remained for 20 years, beachfronters had no possessory or ownership interest in those Class 2 accretions.
Now, let me ask you this. After Act 221, before 73, other than the prohibition against building seawalls, was there and the 20-year requirement for registration, was there any other restriction that applied to the use of that property?
Absolutely. The first point is that those beachfront landowners had no ownership interest in that property, in those accretions during that period, because none of that had reached 20 years and could not have reached 20 years by definition. But also Act 221 put all such accreted land in the conservation district and subjected it to severe use restrictions. And so any claim or any interest in those accreted lands was already diminished by the fact that those lands had been put in the conservation district and subject to severe use restrictions. And this is Act 221, which is not challenged in this case. So by the time Act 73 came along, we already had these accreted lands subject to these severe restrictions in any event. But, of course, the main point is that none of those accreted lands, those Class 2 accretions, were owned by the beachfronter at all because of the 20-year permanency requirement.
Suppose somebody had property that was the 20-year permanence matured, I guess, after they just never got around to registering title, although they had the 20 years and could prove it before Act 73 was passed. Are you saying that they have a vested right?
If those were Class 1 accreted lands, if they had formed prior to Act 221 in 1985, then, of course, they would still, even after Act 73, they could register, they would own it. But if it was a land that accreted after 1985, because of the 20-year requirement imposed by Act 221, none of those contingent interests in those accreted lands could have ever vested and become permanent, because by the time they would have reached 20 years, Act 73 had already come along in the intervening time and said that basically only the state could own the accreted land. And so,
well, what I was asking was, suppose when Act 221 passed, they had 10 years of permanence. And so when you add the 10 years, you have 20 years, which matures before.
They wouldn't need. They wouldn't have to worry, because if at the time Act 221 had passed, they already had 10 years, then those lands would have been Class 1 accreted lands. And so it's our position that Class 1 accreted lands are not affected at all. So they could have registered those lands immediately, or they could have even registered prior to Act 221, because.
Well, what's your response to the appellees or the plaintiffs' argument that in fact the land court didn't follow your interpretation of Class 1 property, because even with respect to lands that had accreted prior to 85, when they try to register it, they still require the 20-year requirement.
Yeah, even if that were true, nothing the plaintiffs say takes issue with our interpretation of Act 73, and because Act 73 is the only thing that is challenged in this case, and there's nothing to suggest that Act 73 was ever applied to Class 1 accreted lands, it really doesn't matter whether their position is right. Act 73 has never been shown to have any impact on Class 1 accreted lands. And since they're challenging Act 73 in this case, not Act 221, there's no basis for claiming that Act 73 had any effect on Class 1 accreted lands, regardless of what our position was with respect to Act 221. But what is clear is that with regard to Act 221, the littoral landowners were never given ownership, registration, quiet title. They were never able to register quiet title or own Class 2 accreted lands because of Act 221's permanency requirement. And so when Act 73 ultimately came along in 2003, those accreted lands were not owned at all by the littoral landowners. And so Act 73, by taking, all it did, it could not have possibly invaded any existing property or possessory or ownership interest in those Class II accretions.
But your interpretation of or treatment of Class II property is dependent upon your argument that Act 221, in fact, cut off all future accretions as of the passage of 221.
Right.
If it didn't, then the only future accretions that we would be looking at are post-Act 73.
Right. Yes, and it is definitely our, and it is our strong position that Act 221 did cut off their ownership interest in those.
So is it or is it not relevant to how the state actually applied 221 in terms of our interpretation of whether 221 actually cut off future accretions or only was a limitation on recordation?
Absolutely, but the plaintiffs never, the only claim they have, the only thing they challenge is how Act 221 was applied to Class I accretions. They don't take issue with how class, with like saying that the state has ever granted Class II owners ownership interest in Class II accretions, even though they couldn't register or acquire title to them. Plaintiffs don't say that the state ever allowed them own. I mean, they claim that as a matter of the law, they own, they, the littoral landowners still own Class II accretions, but they never say that the state ever took that position in land court or otherwise, that they own any, have any ownership interest in Class II accretions. Their only complaint was with regard to Class I accretions. And some parts of the brief might have mixed that up, but in fact, there's never been a position, the state has never been shown to take a position saying that Class II accretions were owned by the littoral landowner. It's always been our consistent position that Class II accretions were not only registrable or quiet titleable by the littoral landowner.
Right, but if the state required a 20-year requirement for Class I property in registration, doesn't that suggest that your interpretation of 221 is incorrect?
No, because Class II property. If we were to interpret Act 221 to allow the littoral landowner the ability to own those new accretions, those new Class II accretions, even though they couldn't register a quiet title to them, it would essentially gut Act 221 because the whole purpose of Act 221 was to ensure public access and to prevent the littoral landowners from basically grabbing newly accreted land. If we were to interpret things the way plaintiffs had it, then any newly accreted land, the littoral landowner would basically be able to exclude anybody from that property. Sure, they couldn't register quiet title to it, but they would have the legal right to exclude anybody from that property, and that would defeat the entire purpose of Act 221. In addition, Act 221 imposed the seawall ban, and the way the seawall ban was constructed, it only actually applies to it does not apply to Class II accreted lands. The way it's defined is it only applies to judicially decreed accreted land under the new statutes, which impose a 20-year permanency requirement. Because no Class II accreted lands could have actually reached 20 years, the seawall ban actually doesn't apply to them. But under our interpretation, it doesn't matter because they would still not be able to build seawalls on Class II accreted lands because they don't own it. But under plaintiff's interpretation, because under their view, the beachfronter would own those accreted lands, and yet there's no seawall ban, then they would be able to build these seawalls on that accreted land in direct violation of the entire, one of the main tenets or one of the main elements of Act 221. And so for two reasons, first that it would essentially gut the whole purpose of Act 221, which is to deny land beachfronters from controlling accreted land and affecting the public access, as well as the seawall ban, which would be effectively nullified with regard to Class II accreted lands. It cannot be that Act 221 allowed beachfronters ownership of accreted land in that interim period.
It seems to me that the premise of your argument is that the state can eliminate future accretion rights without that constituting a taking.
Absolutely. And
is there any authority for that proposition?
Yes, and we cite a few cases in our brief.
A case that not says the concept, but actually applied it to the fact situation. In other words, the state said, okay, from here on after, any future accretions belong to the state, not to the private individual. And the court said, okay, that's not a constitutional taking of property.
Yes, and the Ninth Circuit case, the Western Pacific case, specifically states that the right to future accretions is not a vested right. And there are also, we cite a couple more, or three more cases in our reply brief on
But that is the premise of your argument, right? In other words, if that's wrong, then your argument fails.
Well, it certainly weakens our argument. But, I mean, I think what supports that position is that the United States Supreme Court in the Pearsall case basically defined what a vested right it was versus a contingent right. And a contingent right was one of those that will not take place unless it depends upon the existence of some future event that doesn't happen. In this case, we have a classic situation of that because in this case, because of Act 221, the contingent interest, or the interest in receiving those accretions after they reach 20 years is clearly a contingent one because none of those accretions may not last and may not stay for 20 years. And therefore, that interest in owning those future accretions is clearly contingent upon those accretions remaining for 20 years. And that fits the classic definition under Pearsall of what a contingent right is. And the Hawaii Supreme Court in the Damon versus Tsutsui case adopted and followed the Pearsall test for defining what a contingent right is. And so because Class 2 accretions or any interest in owning those future Class 2 accretions after they reach 20 years is clearly contingent upon those accretions actually staying on for 20 years, you have a contingent interest, which all the courts say the legislature can take away without worrying about the takings clause.
The state hasn't appealed the order certifying the class. Is that?
That's correct. That's correct. I think the fact that this is a class action makes their claim even weaker because, I mean, for them to show a taking, they have to show that, you know, you have to meet those three tests, either the physical invasion, which we don't have here because on Class 2 accretions were not actually owned by the landowners prior to 20 years, the deprivation of all economically beneficial use, which clearly can't be satisfied here because their main parcel is certainly untouched, and their access to the land is untouched. Even though the state may own the accretion, the landowner still has access to the ocean, and that's one of the key essence of a literal landowner's rights.
Well,
that's not affected either.
Absent any concrete action by the state as to a particular property, is the case ripe for adjudication? Is there a takings argument or is it a takings claim if the state hasn't really done anything physically to assert its ownership interest in the property?
I think I think certainly they haven't established any basis for saying that the state meets any of those three tests, that the state physically invaded their property because they didn't own it. They can't show that it deprives them of an economically beneficial use, and nor do they meet the Penn Central test, which looks to the economic impact of the regulation. And because the economic impact here is very small, because one is contingent, it's contingent upon a fortuity that may not occur, that is that the accretion stay for 20 years. Secondly, this land is is in the conservation district and subject also to the public trust doctrine. All those elements weaken their claim and their expectations with regard to the accreted land.
But you will agree that by common law, the literal owner did own the accreted land.
Absolutely.
So by changing the ownership to the state, is that not a taking?
If we're talking about Class 1 accreted lands, where if you were to own the land, and then the state now all of a sudden changes and it says now you no longer own it, that would be a taking, and that's why it makes no sense for us. And that's why we say Act 73 has no application to Class 1 accreted lands, because that would clearly be a taking. And so there's no reason to interpret it that way. But with regard to Class 2 accreted lands, those accreted lands are contingent. They're not in existence. And by the time Act 73 rolled around, Act 221 had already made it such that the littoral landowners had no ownership interest in those accreted lands unless those Class 2 accreted lands, unless and until they remained for 20 years, which is a classic contingent interest, which the case law says you can take away without violating the takings clause.
I think the state argued at trial, though, that or below, that Act 73 constituted a taking as of May 20, 2003. And is that a concession?
I don't believe
that's
we said that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's clearly our position that Act 73 does not do anything with regard to Class 1. As to Class 2, it does not meet any of the three required takings tests. And as to Class 3, which is very clear, as to Class 3 accreted lands, those lands didn't even exist as of Act 73. And so those were doubly contingent interests. And so no matter what, although to find a taking with regard to Class 2 accreted land would be pretty severe, finding a takings with regard to Class 3 accreted lands, which didn't even exist at the time of Act 73, would be especially baseless. So I will reserve the remainder of my time.
I ask one more question? The
yes.
Amicus brief suggests that the state has not waived its sovereign immunity for these claims, and I just wondered, the state didn't raise that, but I just wonder what the state's position was on that.
Yeah, we're not raising a sovereign immunity defense to the takings claim.
To the takings or the injunctive relief?
Either.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Morning, may it please the court. For over 120 years, it has been a bedrock background principle of Hawaii law that the literal owners own to the shore. Over the 120 years, there has been litigation about where exactly that shoreline boundary might be at the vegetation line, the high wash of the waves, and so forth. But there has never been litigation challenging that fundamental principle established in Halstead v. Gay. The state's position here is fundamentally and fatally flawed for four different reasons. And those flaws are demonstrated by the gymnastics that my colleague has to engage in to justify his position here. On one hand, he has to say that Act 221 did more than the legislature expressly said it was intending. On the other hand, he has to say that Act 73 can't be read according to its plain language and leaves open the door to continued registrations of accretion by people who can establish that as of 1985 they had accreted lands. In fact, he's wrong on both accounts, because in Act 221, in enacting Act 221, the legislature made clear that it was not intended in any way to change the established and existing law with respect to the ownership rights of the beachfront owners. All it did was restrict the ability to put in seawalls to preserve the bargain that struck with oceanfront landowners that they're subject to erosion and they have the benefit of accretion. And it put the land into conservation land, which is exactly the kind of regulatory activity which a state can engage in without affecting a taking. But it did not change the nature of the boundary that existed between the private landowners on one side and the state on the other.
Well, Act 221 had its genesis in administration bill. And it says that the purpose of that bill was to determine the presumption. How do you go about proving that you own property?
Right, right. And you know, clearly, if to go back to your question to Mr. Lau earlier, if it's subject to sort of day by day or year by year fluctuations, then you invite controversy. And although a shoreline certification may only be good for a year, it is certainly appropriate for the state to say, we don't want to have a lot of controversy about where it was today and where it was yesterday. We want to be able to establish that whatever might have happened over the short run, this is in fact the kind of long-term imperceptible growth of the shoreline or growth of the upland property that is permitted to the private owner under the common law.
Okay, now, as I understand it, the common law didn't have a permanency requirement. In other words, there was no time period, or correct me if I'm wrong, is that your understanding?
Law? I don't think the common law, you could not find anywhere in the common law a 20-year time period. On the other hand, you can find in the common law a consistent theme, and that is this growth has to be slow, imperceptible, and there has to be some stability to it. It can't appear overnight. By the same token, erosion, the boundary doesn't change when there's erosion that happens overnight.
All right, so there's some implicit time frame involved.
Exactly.
Now, could the state have said, in terms of passed a law that said accretion does not become the property of the owner unless it's permanent for 10 years? Without it constituting a taking under the, in other words, does the state have some authority to impose a permanency requirement before the landowner could assert ownership?
Yeah, I think the answer is no, I believe. And the reason is this, that the deeds we're talking about establish a boundary. It is the same as any other deed boundary. It may not be always described by specific meets and bounds, but it is nevertheless the dividing line between what I own and what you own. And as it moves from place to place over time, it is still the boundary. And I think the state cannot say you can't, it's not your property for 10 years any more than it can say it's not your property at all.
So your position is as soon as an owner buys beachfront property, the right to accretion is part of the bundle of rights that can't be diminished without the state having to compensate the owner from that.
That's correct.
All right, but let me ask you this. And so future accretions by nature are speculative. I mean, so if that's a taking, how would you value that? Prior to it happening, say the state passed a law that said, we're going to take this property, how would you value the value of the future accretions that haven't occurred?
Right. Let me back up just if I could, just for one second, and say that the U.S. Supreme Court has made clear that temporary takings are nevertheless takings. And so that goes back to the 10-year point. With respect to the valuation of the opportunity for future accretion, it is, I think, based on proof that there has been a historical pattern of continued accretion or not. It is based on expert testimony about the probability of future accretion, even in the face of global warming, perhaps, and all the other ways that people determine the value of property to be taken that doesn't exist. I mean, how, for example, does a business owner complain about the loss of future profits? You come to court, you say, this is not speculative. I've got expert testimony that will show that there is a record of, in this case, accretion, and there is good reason to believe that over time I would get something. And then it's up to the court or the jury to put a valuation on it. It's not as easily determined as where there's existing accretion, obviously, where you can measure it by square foot and you can have appraisers say what it's worth. But I think it is amenable to some valuation process with appropriate testimony. Now, the difficulty for the state is that there is no case which allows either the permanent fixing or the changing of a boundary without compensation. You have a variety of cases around the country where the other states attempted to do exactly what the state of Hawaii did here. That is, they said, as of a certain date, this is the boundary, now and forever. And those sorts of boundary-fixing laws have been routinely struck down. What the state relies on wrongly are cases where a private landowner has been affected adversely by government action that was taken pursuant to the government's right as the owner of the submerged lands to act in aid of commerce, to act in aid of navigation, to act for the public interest by putting in a jetty or a groin to limit the flow of sand, to protect a public beach and that sort of thing. But they have no case, and there simply is no case, where the boundary has been moved or fixed against the interests of the private landowners without the courts recognizing that worked a taking.
But under our statute, I mean, can't the legislature always change the common law?
Yes.
At least prospectively.
Well, the legislature can change the common law, but it cannot change the rights that were afforded to a landowner under a deed issued going back to the time of the Mahele or by the government more recently that says your boundary is one that is determined by the shoreline wherever it may move.
Okay. Can we talk about Mauna Loa Bay particularly?
Yes,
then?
Yes,
do you have accreted lands?
They had accreted lands.
Okay, is this the picture that you folks are relying on in the record to explain?
I'm sorry, I can't. Yes.
It looks to me like Bishop Estates sold the plaintiffs the beach reserve, but not the accreted lands that had, I don't know how long those accreted lands were in existence prior to the transfer to the plaintiffs in 2005?
2005, right. Yes. The transfer from Bishop Estate included the beach reserve as it was described by Meets and Bounds, and together with all accretion. And so the plaintiffs do in fact have the interest in the accretion, whatever it may prove to be. Now,
did their rights mature under Act 221 so they could have registered title to the accreted lands?
Well, the fact is after Act 73, although Mr. Lau struggles mightily to say it shouldn't be read the way it read to mean what it says, the land court does not accept accretion petitions, except for those which are expressly allowed, that is, people claiming the right to recover previously eroded land. So, you know, he would like you to say you can't read Act 73 according to its plain language, but that's not, there's no basis for that.
So you're saying that the six people who were able to get their title registered only got their title registered because they were restored accreted lands?
No, the six people who are reflected in the record recorded their interest before Act 73, after Act 221. And when they went into the land court, the state argued and prevailed on the argument that they were required to show that their accretion was had been in existence for 20 years prior to the date of their petition. The notion that Act 221 created a dividing line between what existed before 1985 and what existed afterward is simply a fiction created by the lawyers in this case. And in fact, it is disproven by their successful arguments in the land court that required 20 years up to the time of the petition. They didn't say, we don't care how long it's been there before, if it was there in 85. They argued that it had to be there for 20 years up to the time of the petition. So that's why the six people were able to get their land. And it reflects the fact that Act 221 did not change the law of ownership. It didn't change the boundaries. It didn't fix the boundaries. It simply said, we want to, before somebody comes in and gains the benefit of government affirmation of ownership, as opposed to de facto ownership, which is what the common law provided for owners, because the boundary moves according to where the shoreline may lie. The fact that they came in and demonstrated stability for a period of 20 years, I think demonstrates what we've said, which is Act 221 didn't change the law the way Mr. Lau argues.
Under your view, wouldn't 221 have constituted unconstitutional taking to the extent it prohibited the landowners from building walls or otherwise asserting ownership of that property in the interim?
No, it didn't. It didn't prohibit them from asserting ownership. It prohibited them from quieting title or completing the registration process. But the de facto rights of ownership remained unaffected. And to the extent that the Act 221 prohibited the building of seawalls, that's the kind of regulatory action which under Penn Central is permitted without working a taking. And with respect to the placement in the conservation district, that's the kind of thing that Penn Central allows. It's, you know, part of the social bargain. Sometimes you have land that's in a apartment zone. Sometimes you have land that's in a conservation zone.
Under your interpretation of 221, what could the landowners do in the accreted portion of their property?
The landowner could have, at that time, gone forward and zoning and building laws permitted, fenced it off. He could have said, this is my land, I own it, this is where the shoreline is. If somebody objected, they could have complained about it.
But he fenced it off between the ocean on the seaward boundary.
Right. He could have stored his property there. He could have put, you know, his own boats there and excluded others who tried to do the same. He had all the attributes of ownership except record title. But it was clearly his because that's where the boundary lie.
But probably not able to construct any structure on it. given the conservation district?
Probably not. I mean, it would depend on a lot of factors that are unique probably to each parcel, but it would certainly be subject to the setback rules and so forth that are applicable to every landowner in one form or another.
I'm a little bit curious about the remedy that your client sought here.
Right.
Because normally you don't get injunctive relief if damages are available. And if you're saying that they effectuated a taking, isn't your remedy to get damages?
Well, but for the decision in Allen versus Honolulu, I would have said yes. The problem that we had in looking at remedies here is that the Supreme Court's decision in Allen indicated that an injunctive remedy is appropriate where there is an uncompensated taking instead of uncompensated taking that's affected by legislation. If the government has taken no steps to provide compensation because it is a legislative function to make the decision to pay. And so if you take the Allen case and you take the other federal cases we cited where the courts have barred enforcement of a legislative taking, and make no mistake, here there is a per se taking. It's not the kind of regulatory adjustment of or modification of the sticks of ownership that Mr. Lau would have you believe. In fact, it went from being private land to being state land. But for those cases, I would say yes, pay.
But your clients bought the land after Act 73 was passed. So you already knew that there were these restrictions on the property, and yet you purchased the land.
Well, of course, but that doesn't mean that the deeds changed, which is what Act 73 in effect does, and it doesn't mean that the rights of ownership changed in any respect, except for the limited kinds of restrictions imposed. I'm sorry, our clients bought after Act 221. They didn't buy.
Didn't they buy in 2005?
They bought their lots, they bought the beach reserve, and got the accretion rights. But they simply tacked on to the rights of Kamehameha Schools, and under the Palazzolo decision, it's clear that absent some payment of compensation to somebody, the current owner retains the right to continue to pursue takings claims.
But the deed for the beach reserve, had all these covenants in them, which basically said the public has a right to use this. It's pretty restricted.
All of which goes to valuation, potentially, if there's to be a taking, but it doesn't go fundamentally to the right of ownership. It simply does not affect their right to own that property and to establish their title to it.
But if the state passes a law that says from henceforward, all future accretions belong to the state.
Right.
Doesn't the valuation of the taking establish at that time? In other words, say in 2003 they passed a law and it's prospective then.
Right.
And at that point there's no accretion. 2005 there's an accretion. You don't look to see what the accretion was as of 2005. Don't you look to as of 2003 what the potential for accretion was that was being taken by the state?
Right.
That's why, in effect, it does make a difference. Assuming we're construing 221 and 73 as prospectively taking these right. bundled rights, it makes a big difference as to when the state prospectively took those or asserted the right to those properties.
For the purpose of valuation under eminent domain law, it is the date of taking that fixes the valuation. After that, there's a right. There's a constitutional right to interest. I think if we were ever to go to trial on the question of compensation, clearly showing what happened after 2003 would be useful evidence for the purpose of reducing the uncertainty about the nature of the prospective interest. But I agree with you that the valuation date is as of 2003, not some later date when compensation is actually paid. Mr. Lau, the state relies on the Western Pacific Railway case. There are multiple problems with relying on that case. First, in the Strand case, which is cited in our brief, the California Supreme Court expressly disavowed the Western Railway case and said the Ninth Circuit got it wrong as a matter of California law. Second, that was a case where the claimant traced his title to a government entity which, as the Ninth Circuit said, had no authority to convey more than it owned, and it didn't own any right to accretion. So you've got that problem as well. And thirdly, it was a case where you had this tension between the rights of the submerged landowner who was adjacent to the private landowner, and what the sovereign was doing in that case was acting in aid of navigation and commerce. And the cases all indicate that where there is that sort of effort, the private landowner can't complain that the possibility of future accretion has been disrupted. It's the same for the cases where there's piers, where there's jetties, and so on. All of those cases are different than where the state has simply redrawn the boundary line.
Are there any clear cases on point in which the issue is, can the state pass a law that says future accretions belong to the state? Not a question of they're going backward and trying to take accretions that are already in existence when the statute was passed, but a prospective statute that says future accretions belong to the state.
Yes, there's the Purdy case from New Hampshire. There's the, I think it's, there's a case from Florida we cited, I believe it's the National Properties case, and then there is a third case from Michigan. All of those cases deal with situations where the sovereign has drawn a line and said, this is the boundary, and beyond that time, I've set a boundary at a specific time and said beyond that it's our property. Well, they all strike those kinds of restrictions down based in part on Washington v. Hughes, where the state of Washington attempted something like that in its constitution, which the U.S. Supreme Court disallowed. Now, the majority in that case didn't address the impact of that, but Mr. Justice Stewart did and explained the analysis and explained why that is not a permitted action without compensation.
Supreme Court kind of did that in State versus Zimmering.
Yes, obviously with a different result in the sense that they declared as a matter of Hawaii law that land created by volcanic action isn't the same as accretion, but that is a entirely different process. Because, and in State versus Zimmering, they did not question the fundamental bedrock principle that's found in Halstead v. Gay that the boundary is where the shoreline is at all times and for all purposes. Now, Mr. Lau suggests that the state has never argued that there was a taking. I think, as you acknowledged during the trial below, or during the hearing below, there was an acknowledgement that the state has effectively taken the rights to future accretion. Now, he says that's not a compensable interest, but in fact, because it's a boundary change and not simply a modification of rights of use in a reasonable fashion, it is, in fact, unquestionably a taking. And for all those reasons, Your Honors, I would ask that you affirm the ruling below. And if you do anything with respect to the remedy, it should only be to remand for the purposes of calculating the compensation that's owed. And I have nothing more.
So if you're saying that Act 73 effectuated taking,
yes,
is there a statute of limitations that applies to lawsuits for inverse condemnation?
Yes, and that's why we filed this lawsuit when it was filed, because it was filed within 2 years after the adoption of Act 73 and sought alternatively compensation and or an injunction against enforcement if the state was going to take no steps to provide a compensation remedy.
The takings cases are usually case by case.
I understand, and if the state thought that was a good defense A good defense to this assertion of this case is, or the presentation of this case is, a class action. They could and should have raised that, and to the extent that they did so below, they could and should have raised it here. But we've now preserved the claim for the benefit of all the landowners statewide. And if it comes to a question of valuation, the court below can conduct proceedings as it deems appropriate. I don't think, for example, with respect to any particular area like Kailua Beach, it's necessary to go landowner by landowner by landowner with individual lawsuits. The evidence would be that in a particular area, oceanfront land is worth X dollars per square foot, and you can make an appropriate mass valuation. There is authority for class actions in condemnation cases, and obviously the state isn't challenging that as a possible way to resolve this if you uphold the ruling by Judge Hefo, and if, as Mr. Bennett has said indirectly through his deputies, the state will compensate if there's been a taking.
No, I have a conceptual question. So your view of it is that the state has the authority to regulate in the sense of certainly past regulations like the seawall restriction, which would prohibit a landowner from making permanent or doing anything that would affect the natural accretion or reduction of property, like building a seawall so that they extend out their property and then
drop a seawall
and then it erodes, and then they've already appropriated that land.
Right.
So the state clearly could regulate it, that could prohibit any oceanfront landowner from doing anything that would permanently appropriate and stop the natural progression of accretion without constitutive taking.
As a general principle, I think there are exceptions to that, but generally yes.
So in other words, your view of it is the state has the authority to heavily regulate this area. It just can't say this property is our property.
Correct.
Without
it can't
compensating
say,
for it.
What it cannot say is your boundary is someplace other than your deed describes it to be. It cannot say through the Mahele or otherwise, we have issued a deed that says the shoreline is the boundary, and then come back without affecting a taking and saying, your boundary isn't there anymore. Your boundary is someplace else. Your boundary is back where the shoreline might have been 20, 40, 80 years ago, resulting in, you know, this historical, this situation where the actual boundaries recognized by the state are the result of sort of a historical, or a series of historical accidents. If one neighbor got accretion in 1950, another got it in 1970, another got it in 1990, that's where their boundaries are. If another neighbor didn't think it was worth the effort to get to claim and record the accretion, their boundary is back someplace else. And so you have this sort of irrational system of redrawing the boundaries for the beachfront owners, when in fact what those beachfront owners are entitled to is what their deed says, that the boundary is at the shore, wherever that moves, in and out, with you know, the fate of the fort, as Mother Nature may smile on you, or frown, as the case might be.
And can you tell me anything about the Mauna Loa Bay? Was the accretion, how long has this accretion been in existence?
Since before the time, as I understand it, since before the time of the, since before 1985. I don't know, I can't pin it down exactly.
But they never registered title?
No.
And there seems to be an indication in the record that the beach reserve that was deeded to your clients had a lot of seawalls on them. So if there were seawalls along that area, right, it wouldn't be natural accretion, right?
Well, if, you know, the seawalls certainly disrupt the pattern, the natural pattern of erosion and accretion. For many years, seawalls were permitted as a matter of course by the state and local government. If there was accretion in front of those seawalls, since seawalls are generally recognized as inhibiting accretion, you know, it has to be part of a natural process that's occurred despite the existence of the seawall. It's, you know, no one puts in a seawall to encourage accretion. You put it in to prevent erosion that's going to take your home away. But so that if there was accretion in front of the seawalls, it is something that is, like anything else, subject to, like any other form of accretion, you know, something that changes the boundary. What's prohibited is actions by the private landowner that are designed to artificially increase accretion or to change the boundary in some fashion. All right.
Thank you very much.
Just briefly, Your Honor, as to Judge Watanabe's point about takings claims normally being done on an individualized case-by-case basis, that is exactly correct. And in fact, contrary to what plaintiffs have said, we did specifically raise in our opening brief this point. We said at footnote 20, at the very least, plaintiffs have not established on an individualized case-by-case basis that Act 73 so significantly defeated substantial investment-backed expectations as to each and every one of their class two accretions so as to tilt the Penn Central balance in their favor. And accordingly, at a very minimum, summary judgment for the entire class was plainly inappropriate. By pursuing their takings claim as a class action, which includes all private oceanfront landowners, plaintiffs have de facto brought a facial challenge to Act 73's impact on class two accretions. Such a facial challenge necessarily fails unless Act 73 effects a taking as to each and every one of those class two accretions, which clearly plaintiffs have not established, especially when you apply any of those three tests, whether it's the Penn Central test, the deprivation of all economically beneficial use, or the physical invasion test. They can't possibly have established that with respect to each and every single one of their class members. As to Judge Nakamura's point as to whether the state could impose a permanency requirement in the future, the answer is absolutely yes. With respect to imposing a permanency requirement with regard to accretions that have not yet existed, those accretions are clearly contingent interest that may or may not ever exist. And as a result, under the Pearsall test, the U.S. Supreme Court's Pearsall test, and the Hawaii Supreme Court's Damon versus Tsutsui, which adopts the Pearsall test, any such contingent interest is can be taken away. Secondly, with regard to Class II accretions, although those accretions did exist at the time of Act 73, they were not owned in any way by the landowners, and therefore, again, whether those interests would have matured into a real actual ownership interest was dependent upon the contingency of those accretions staying for 20 years. So again, under the Pearsall-Damon test, there are contingent interests that the state can take away without violating the takings clause. The plaintiffs say that they cite these boundary-fixing cases, but those cases do not involve contingent interest as we have here. You have to remember that all their cases don't involve the situation we have here where Act 221 changes the entire picture, because Act 221 comes in and prior to Act 73 changes the common law and says that landowners do not own their accreted land rights until those things mature after 20 years. And because of that, that creates a contingency which changes the entire picture, and therefore plaintiff's cases simply don't have any applicability.
Did 221 also include the making the accretion land a conservation district?
Yes, absolutely.
Does that cut against your argument that the state automatically owned it? If the state owned it, would they need to zone it conservation if it automatic? In other words, if it's true that 221 cut off the, until 20 years expired, it was owned by the state, would they need to zone it conservation? Why couldn't, if they owned it, why do they care what it's zoned?
Well, it's because at that time there was potential that those accretions could have existed for 20 years. Had Act 73 not come around, some of those accretions could have remained for 20 years, at which case it would be owned by the landowner, and then they would then be subject to the conservation district requirements.
It's a very funky ownership thing. In other words, you're saying it is owned by the state, but it would spring back to the landowner's ownership if the accretion lasted for 20 years.
Yes, and that, I think that is the natural reading of the Act. And as to Judge Nakamura's point about it being speculative as to valuation, I think the fact that it's speculative as to valuation when Act 73 came into existence also goes to the issue of whether there would be a taking. Because, again, as takings are done on a case-by-case basis, because it would be speculative as to what potential future accretions would exist, it seems impossible to understand how a court could ever determine that Act 73 affected takings under any of the three takings tests when we don't even know what it actually would have taken, because it's speculative as to what accretions would have come about and would have ever occurred. And so how anyone could possibly show that this act took affected such a change in their economic situation when we don't even know what the situation is, because we don't know what accretions would or would not have ever come about, I think highlights the fact and highlights the point that this really is a contingent interest and it cannot be determined to be a taking for that very reason.
Did either Act 221 or 73 change the boundary in the deed?
It changed what it did. What Act 221 did was say that no longer would new accretions automatically accrue right immediately to the literal landowner. And to that extent, that could be deemed as changing the effect of the deed. And that's and again, Act 221 is not challenged in this case. The only thing that is challenged in this case is Act 73. And so by the time Act 73 came around, because Act 221 had changed the situation so that accreted lands were no longer owned by the littoral landowner, Act 73 did was change a hope that accreted land would actually remain for 20 years.
So the answer is 221 changed the boundary in the deed. Because of 221, Act 73 did not. That's your position.
That is a rough representation of our position. Yes.
Well, prior to Act 221, did anyone ever register title to accreted lands?
I believe they did. It's my understanding that they would have registered just as they would have in any other normal situation. It's certainly not our position that they could not do that. And the significance of Act 221 was to say that with regard to new accretions occurring after 1985, none of those could be registered owned unless they stayed for 20 years. And so until that happens, the littoral landowner simply has no ownership interest in those accretions. And therefore, when Act 73 came along, it didn't take away any existing possessory or ownership interest at all. It merely, at worst, took away a contingency, a mere hope that these lands would remain for 20 years. And under any of the takings tests, it doesn't satisfy the Penn Central test or the deprivation of all economically beneficial use, or much less the physical invasion test. With regard to the relief here, I think it's important to note that the circuit court never issued any injunctive relief, and so the issue of whether or not the circuit court could issue an injunction or not is really not before this court. The circuit court didn't issue injunctive relief. Plaintiffs did not cross appeal from that, and so that issue is not before this court. But what I would say, if the court were to address it, is that it's really up to the state to decide whether or not it chooses. If this court were to find the taking, which we don't think is proper, but if it were to find the taking, it's up to the state to decide whether it would want to pursue it and pay just compensation. It's not up to the plaintiffs to say they can enjoin it. It's the state's choice to decide if it wants to continue with the action and pay compensation, or it can choose to decide not to enforce the act and avoid compensation. That would be the state's decision. And the city, the case that plaintiffs cite actually supports that, saying it's up, in that case it was the city, and they said it's up to the city to make that decision. But again, for the reasons stated earlier, we think there's no takings with regard to Class 1 accretions because Act 73 had no effect on Class 1 accretions. With regard to Class 2 accretions, there's no takings because at the time Act 73 occurred, Act 221 had already made it such that the plaintiffs had no existing vested interest in those accretions. And as to Class 3 accretions, those accretions didn't even exist at the time of Act 73, and so they were doubly contingent. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel. Take the matter under advisement.